This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Not That Kind of Girl. Written by Siobhan Vivian. Narrated by Emma Meltzer.
Prologue. On the first day of my senior year, I happened to walk past the auditorium during the freshman orientation assembly. One of the two heavy oak doors, each with the Ross Academy crest inset in stained glass, had been propped open. There were only enough students inside to occupy the first few rows of stiff, uncomfortable seats, and the emptiness gave the place a hollow sound that surely made the freshmen feel even smaller and more overwhelmed. I had a free period and a hall pass, so I ducked inside, for old time's sake. It took all of 3 minutes before I wanted to scream. Freshman orientation is a colossal waste of time. Or at least the way our school handles it. Forcing new students to sit through a word-for-word recitation of the Ross Academy handbook, performed in a monotone by the guidance counselor nearest to death. There weren't many do's in the Ross Academy handbook. It was pretty much a recitation of don'ts, from don't use your phones during school hours to don't run at an inappropriate pace in the hallways. More than half the students struggled to stay awake, while the rest focused on subtly and not so subtly checking each other out. If it were up to me, things would be run a lot differently. First off, I'd split up freshman orientation by gender. For boys, there'd be a simple presentation done in 10 minutes, tops. In fact, I could probably cancel their assembly altogether and just hand out a memo, because there were only 3 things that added up to a successful high school experience for guys. Doing your homework, wearing a condom, if you were so lucky, and deodorizing your leather school shoes every night. Because foot sweat plus polyester dress socks makes for unbelievably rank conditions. Obviously, things would be more involved for the girls. I'd run their orientation like those scare-em-straight drunk driving lectures, where the police department parks a mangled, twisted car on the front lawn of school, and a guest speaker cries about how he accidentally killed his best friend on the way home from a party. Except, instead of the danger of drunk driving, I'd have a speaker talk firsthand about the danger of high school boys. I know one girl who'd be perfect. She was in my class freshman year. She was nice. Friendly, even to weird kids. Popular, but not enough to make someone jealous. And pretty in a way that was easily overlooked. A few weeks after starting high school, she hit social pay dirt. She found herself a boyfriend. Chad Rivington stood almost twice her height. An intimidating size until you watched him tuck himself into his rusted baby blue VW bug, which he loved even as it fell apart. He was a senior with decent grades, nice teeth, and a spot on the varsity basketball team. In other words, he was a catch for a girl of any grade, but especially for a freshman. They met in the nurse's office, her with a migraine, him brandishing a savage paper cut with the hope of escaping Spanish too. By the end of the week, they were a couple. By the end of the month, they were the couple. They fooled around, of course, but she took things slow, preferring sweet kisses while walking through piles of crispy autumn leaves over half-naked wrestling matches in Chad's cramped back seat. On their 2-month anniversary, Chad asked her to sneak out of algebra and meet him in the boys' locker room for a secret celebration. The girl had never done anything like that before, but it seemed a fun and exciting dare. Though they hadn't said, "I love you," yet, she felt it every time Chad laced their fingers together. Just a week before, after drinking her first 3 beers at a house party, she'd almost let it slip, but she decided to save it for a special occasion, like a 2-month anniversary. After glancing over her shoulder, the girl slid inside the boys' locker room and tiptoed down to the very last row of lockers. Chad greeted her with a grin. A moment later, before they'd even said hello, they were kissing, which quickly turned into groping. It seemed as if her private school uniform had been tailored for this sort of rushed encounter. He had his hands all over her. All over her. And for the first time in their relationship, she didn't worry about where they would go. It was romantic and sexy, and everything inside her melted. Chad had more experience with these sorts of things. and she finally let herself enjoy that. They might have gone all the way if they'd been in Chad's bedroom or even in the VW, but they weren't near a bed or a back seat. They were in a stinky locker room next to a fifth period gym class, and with every shout for a pass, trill of the whistle, or raucous cheer that leaked in, the danger of being discovered fanned the fog from the girl's good judgment. "I can't," she said suddenly. "Not there, not then." Chad tried to convince her with words, with kisses, but now she was the opposite of melting. She pulled away from Chad's mouth and said she'd better get back to class. Chad sagged with disappointment, a familiar posture from their last few dates, though somehow weightier in this instance. He pleaded with her to stay. After all, she'd barely touched him, and he was so turned on. It was only fair to finish what they'd started, right? She insisted she had to get back to algebra, sweetly, apologetically, and when she noticed how bummed Chad continued to look, she leaned in to kiss him. A cute peck aimed for the tip of his nose to make it all okay. She felt three words float up in her throat, ready at last to be said. Except Chad turned his head. The girl felt bad as she hurried back to class. She felt even worse after school when she came upon some guys razzing Chad next to the smoker's tree. He walked toward his car without so much as a head nod in her direction. The girl didn't know that Chad's inability to get off with a freshman had become a running joke, a social liability. Even Chad himself had made light of it for weeks, thinking his friends might ease up if he played along. So he'd complain of blue balls after he'd drive her home, or hump his locker door in mock frustration after the girl hugged him good morning before homeroom. Things like that. But Chad's participation only made the others' comments seem more welcome. The teasing became less funny and more personal. It was one of Chad's friends who suggested the locker room makeout session.
"Use the anniversary,"
the guy urged.
"It's foolproof."
It seemed to Chad like everyone in school had their eyes on the clock during fifth period. Everyone expected him to finally get some. And when he came up short, Chad settled on an excuse that would let him entirely off the hook. When the girl got to school the next morning, whispers hissed like poison arrows aimed at her back. Boys who'd been nice to her at parties, senior girls who'd just started to warm up to her infiltration of their group, now seemed cold and dismissive. Even some of her own classmates, the ones she'd helped usher into the exclusive upperclassmen world, suddenly looked down on her. She couldn't understand it, at least not until she saw Chad and he guiltily headed in the wrong direction so he wouldn't have to talk to her. After homeroom, the sniffing started. Someone would do it whenever she walked by. She didn't think much of it. It was the height of cold season, but it kept happening. Sniff, 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 everywhere she went. It wasn't until lunch when one of Chad's friends commandeered the whiteboard and named the fish stick entree after her that she figured it out.
"She just grossed me out too much,"
she could imagine Chad saying.
"I almost gagged, she smelled so bad."
So stupid, so thoughtless, so untrue. But that was all it took. It was over. They were over. She was over. The initial wave of teasing tapered off after a few months, like any stupid catchphrase or slogan. Chad never apologized. Maybe he cleared his conscience by admitting to someone that it was only a dumb joke, but he said nothing to the girl. And someone else took the baton that spring, when a junior supposedly had a three-way in her parents' shower with two of Chad's teammates. But the girl? It changed her. The way she walked, how often she raised her hand in class, what she'd dared to put on her plate at lunch. She was never the same girl again. Not really. She was fish sticks. That was why trusting boys was just like drinking and driving. Sure, some people took the risk. One or two beers never feels dangerous at the time, and not everyone who drinks and drives gets into an accident. But to me, it was obvious. Why would you even take the chance? So, yeah, orientation should be something more like that. We could provide something useful instead of policies on locker maintenance. Hearing a story like that was just as important as knowing your blood type or if you're allergic to bee stings. It was information that could save a girl's life. Chapter 1. It was the start of our senior year, and my best friend Autumn was feeling nostalgic. She took pictures when we picked up our schedules from the guidance office for the last time, called it divine intervention that even though we had only two periods in common, the rest were still close enough that we could always walk together. She reminisced about junior year as if it had been decades ago. Even the state of my appearance after swim class, wet hair hanging like long brown icicles, melting pool water onto my navy cardigan, could make her wistful.
"You smell like summer," she said,
resting her head on my shoulder.
"I wish it was still summer."
I turned and sniffed my cardigan. Though I'd had it dry cleaned right before school started, it already reeked of tangy chlorine, so I peeled it off and tied it around my waist. Coach Fallon never sent us to the locker room with enough time to shower. He'd rather us suffer one more lap of butterfly than have 30 seconds to shampoo. Autumn was so lucky that she hurt her shoulder a few years back and had a doctor's note to keep her out of the pool.
"Hey,"
I said,
"could you give me a French braid when we get to class?"
I hated the way it dried after swim class in dull, matted clumps. Autumn's shoulder-length hair was twisted into two perfectly symmetrical blonde sections. She could make it that good without a mirror.
"Here,"
she said, pulling off my tortoiseshell headband before dropping a step behind me.
"I'll do it now."
That's how we walked through the freshman hallway, me leading Autumn by my hair like we were elephants. I kept my head down and asked her questions from my Western philosophy notes while she went to work, my scalp tightening with every weave. Our first quiz was in 5 minutes. We'd studied on the phone together the night before, so it was really more of a review, but Autumn had still gotten a few easy ones wrong.
"I can't believe it."
Autumn stopped walking, only I didn't realize it until my head snapped back. She sighed and asked,
"Were we ever that young?"
I could tell that Autumn was trying to soak up all the excitement and possibility exuding from the freshmen mulling around us. She was completely charmed by their goofiness, bad skin, and awkward roughhousing. She smiled so wide, the skin around her blue eyes wrinkled. I smiled too. Except I wasn't thinking back so much as trying to hold on to every minute of senior year. If our dream colleges accepted us, Autumn and I would be living on opposite sides of the country in 11 months. The realist in me had to accept that things wouldn't be the same. Or, at least, not nearly as good as how we had it right now. Autumn would make new friends. Hopefully, I would too. But it wasn't a prospect I was particularly excited about.
"Oh, geez," she whispered. "Natalie, look."
Autumn nudged her chin toward a curvy girl with black corkscrew curls. The girl was kneeling on the floor, reaching deep into a messy locker for her books. Her pleated uniform skirt tipped forward like a ringing church bell. A small triangle of lavender mesh barely shielded her rear from the entire hallway. Though it wasn't actually written anywhere in the Ross Academy handbook, it still seemed like every girl at school knew enough to wear something unrevealing underneath her uniform skirt. Spandex shorts, boxers, leggings, or at the very least a pair of hipster underwear. Every girl but this poor, clueless freshman. I debated whether or not to say something, but only for a second because if I had a piece of spinach in my teeth or if my zipper was down, I'd rather be told than make a complete fool of myself. Embarrassing moments had a surprisingly long shelf life at our school. 1 minute you were a normal girl, and the next you'd be known as Ass Flasher for the next 4 years. It seemed only right to intervene. I handed my notebook to Autumn. "Reread my notes on the Socratic method. I'll be right back." I bounded across the hallway, my braid unraveling with every step. A couple of freshman boys had taken notice of the free show and were panting at this girl's butt. I stare them down and position myself to block their view. "Hey," I said to the girl, "can I talk to you for a second?" She stared up at me from the floor, her tanned face appearing slightly lighter around her eyes, probably from lying out with an oversized pair of sunglasses.
Sure.
Her voice was both friendly and suspicious. "I'm Natalie Sterling," I said, feeling like I probably should introduce myself. "What's your name?" She blinked a few times and then stood up, which, to my great relief, solved the immediate problem of her unfortunate underwear choice.
"Hold on. You're Natalie Sterling?"
Yes, I said, and suddenly I turned into the suspicious one. Her brown eyes were big and expectant, glittering like the eyeshadow dusting her lids. She waited, and not exactly patiently, for me to recognize her.
"You don't know who I am, do you?"
She didn't sound angry. If anything, she seemed tickled. My mind cycled through the faces at my SAT summer prep course, but this girl was clearly a freshman, so that didn't make any sense. I shrugged apologetically. "Are you sure you don't have me confused with someone else?"
"Okay."
She closed her eyes and shook her head back and forth a few times, really fast.
"I can't believe I'm about to do this."
And then, after a deep breath, she danced a jig right there in front of her locker. Her toned legs kicked and sliced the air like scissors, and her flats hit the linoleum floor in loud slaps that made everyone take notice. My own deficiency in dance kept me from knowing if she was good or just trying hard. Either way, she bounced with such fervor that her curls boinged like a thousand tiny springs. After a final twirl, which honestly couldn't have come quickly enough, she threw out her hands and exclaimed,
"River dance!"
Except she said it with a terrible Irish brogue, and it sounded more like "River dance." That's when it hit me. Spencer Biddle? The 8-year-old girl I'd babysat for an entire summer when I turned 12? Spencer Biddle, who wouldn't use the upstairs bathroom without someone standing outside the door, who would eat macaroni and cheese only if the cheese were orange, who put on elaborate Irish step dancing shows in her living room? Her chest heaved as she caught her breath.
"I'm honestly relieved you didn't recognize me. It's been like, what, almost 6 years? I'd better look completely different."
"Don't worry," I said, squinting past her makeup and imagining her shiny curls uncoiling to a frizzy and unkempt little girl fro. "You definitely do." Spencer pushed some wet hair off my shoulder.
"I hardly recognized you either. I mean, look at how grown up and beautiful you are."
It was a weird compliment, like something my Aunt Doreen or Grammy would say, not someone 3 years younger than me.
"Seriously, Natalie," she continued, "you were the nicest babysitter I ever had. I remember one time when you threatened to make Eddie Guevara eat rocks when he'd peed on the flowers we just planted around the mailbox."
I winced. "Did I really?" Spencer laughed the same way she used to, quiet puffs of air that pulsed out of her nose, rapid fire.
"All the neighbor boys were afraid of you. It was so awesome."
"Didn't your family move to St. Louis?"
"Yeah, when my mom got remarried. But she divorced my stepdad, so we came back this summer."
I nodded, even though it felt weird to be discussing things like divorce with Spencer. I was pretty sure that our last conversation involved me trying to convince her that Lucky Charms would make a terrible pizza topping.
"We're renting an apartment across Liberty River. It's not bad, actually. My room has these big mirrored closet doors where I can practice my routines."
"You dance to anything," I recalled. "Commercials, those wind chimes your mom hung on the front porch, the sound of the phone ringing." I had a sudden memory of how annoying that actually was from a babysitter's perspective. I could hardly get Spencer to sit still. Spencer's glossy smile gave way to a pucker.
"Wait. If you didn't recognize me, why did you come over here in the first place?"
I picked some lint off my skirt and suddenly wish that I didn't know the color of Spencer's underwear. I leaned in close enough to smell her cotton candy perfume and whispered, "When you bent over before, you could see everything, and a bunch of boys were enjoying the view." Her mouth dropped open so wide I could see her fillings.
"Are you kidding?"
I shook my head. Despite being embarrassed, Spencer managed a smile. "You know," I told her, "Ross does offer a pair of uniform pants for the girls, but there are these horrible pleated slacks the color of cardboard. Really, the best thing to do is to wear something underneath your skirt." I gave her the rundown of options and even lifted my skirt the tiniest bit to show her the navy spandex shorts I always, always wore, even over tights during winter. Spencer nodded, but now she was looking behind me, trying to figure out which of the boys had been staring at her. The warning bell rang. I needed to hurry to class so I could get settled and focus before the quiz. "I'm sure I'll see you around, Spencer. And let me know if you have any questions about school stuff."
"Believe me, I definitely plan on exploiting that I'm friends with a senior. All the other freshman girls are going to die of jealousy."
I knew that wouldn't actually be true, but hearing Spencer say it made me feel pretty good as I hustled across the hallway to avoid being trampled by our entire football team. Connor Hughes, all tall and lean with his wavy brown hair grazing the collar of his white button-up, led the charge of boys down the hall. He held a playbook in his hands, and the rest of his teammates orbited him, peering inside. Autumn closed my notebook and handed it back to me.
"I don't know where you get your courage, Natalie. I couldn't say anything like that to a stranger."
I lifted my eyebrows. "That was no stranger." I told Autumn the story, and she glanced across the hallway.
"So, wait, were you too busy catching up with Spencer that you forgot to tell her about her underwear?"
I turned and saw Spencer bent over again, her butt back on display for everyone. The eyes of the passing football players flitted to the left, as if Spencer's ass gave off a high-pitched noise at a frequency that only boys could detect. One of the guys, Mike Domsky, snatched the binder out of Connor's hands and flapped it furiously toward Spencer's rear end, trying to make a strong enough breeze so her skirt would flutter up even higher. The rest of the team fell all over each other in a fit of laughter. A sour feeling rippled across my stomach. Spencer spun around and pressed up against her locker, a look of pretend embarrassment, feigned modesty painted on her face, the same what I'd fallen for a moment ago.
"Looks like Spencer's grown up to be quite a lady," Autumn said.
She meant it as a joke, I think, except neither of us laughed.
Chapter 2. I left extra, extra early the next morning and picked up 2 egg sandwiches and 2 Orangina's from the bagel shop on Main Street. It was the first official day of student council elections, and I wanted to get my posters hung up before anyone else, claim the best wall real estate. When I got to Autumn's house, I beeped my car horn along with a song snippet played in between NPR news stories. Across the street, an old lady in a flowered nightgown stared me down from behind her screen door. I mouthed an embarrassed apology. Autumn finally appeared, darting across her lawn in bare feet. Her black flats were perched on top of the books clutched in her hands, a pair of wrinkled cream-colored knee socks slung over her shoulder. My campaign posters were tucked under her arm.
"Careful you don't bend them," I called.
I could tell Autumn hadn't bothered to shower that morning, preferring instead to sleep an extra 20 minutes. I had always been an early riser, but Autumn loved to sleep, so I'd make sure to always have a book underneath my pillow whenever we had sleepovers. Lately, I only read SAT prep guides, but that's how I devoured the entire Goosebumps series during middle school, next to my snoring best friend. Autumn crouched down to the open passenger window and tipped her books forward, causing her shoes to fall onto the seat. She brightened when she saw the white paper bag.
"Ooh, breakfast."
"Your reward for getting up early to help me." I don't need a reward, she said, throwing her books in the back seat and then gently laying my posters on top. After all, I'm your unofficial campaign manager.
I wish you'd be my official vice president, I said under my breath.
Autumn sighed as she dropped into the passenger seat and clicked her seatbelt into the latch with way more force than necessary.
Natalie, you have to let this go.
I'd posed the idea countless times during the summer, and as recently as this weekend, when we'd stayed up until 3 in the morning painting campaign posters. I'd painted one poster with both our names on it, but Autumn just complained that I'd wasted a perfectly good piece of oak tag.
Good ideas are hard to let go, I said.
She took a big bite of sandwich and got some ketchup on her face. I handed her a napkin.
Look, she said in between chews, it means a lot to me that you think I could actually do something like this, but it's not like I need to be vice president to help with all your projects. I'll still be at every student council meeting, just like I've been the last 3 years.
It's not about you showing up to meetings. It's about you living up to your full potential, Autumn. You always say that you're more of a behind-the-scenes person, but that's not true. It's just a convenient excuse not to be noticed. College admission counselors don't just want to know that you've participated in extracurricular activities. They want to see leadership skills, that you can take charge of something. Autumn opened her Orangina and chugged down about 5 huge gulps. A tiny part of me thought she might be considering it. Then she changed the subject, asking,
What were some of those funny slogans we came up with? I was trying to remember them this morning.
I couldn't force my best friend to run for student council. I knew she had to want it for herself, but that didn't make it any less frustrating. For the rest of the ride to school, we tried to remember the corny slogans that made us laugh so hard this weekend, like, Vote for Natalie! She'll do things Natalie! Except without being sugar drunk on Dr. Pepper and cookie dough, they weren't really funny at all. Ours was the first car in the student parking lot. Ross Academy looked beautiful, the sun rising behind the fieldstone walls, sparking off the dew on the thick lawn. I was so taken with the beauty of our school that it wasn't until I'd gotten halfway up the path when I noticed that every single window had been covered over with white paper.
That's weird, I said.
Looks like Kevin Stroop's seriously stepping up his game, Autumn said.
I guess.
Kevin Stroop was last year's treasurer and, as far as I knew, the only person running against me for president. I'd been counting on an easy campaign, mainly because I was last year's vice president, but also because Kevin had made a stupid accounting error that had nearly left us bankrupt. We'd had to enforce a strict one-slice-per-person rule at the end-of-the-year pizza party, which no one had been happy about. I pulled open the main door, and hundreds of pieces of paper fluttered with the fall breeze I'd invited in. They weren't just taped to the windows. Our entire school had been wallpapered. The bathroom doors, bulletin boards, every locker, and the trophy case. An empty plastic tape dispenser crunched beneath my loafer as I stepped forward. Several dozen others were discarded on the floor, down the length of the hallway. I knew Kevin didn't have the chops to pull off a stunt this big. I pulled a single sheet from the spout of a water fountain. It was a piece of photocopied notebook paper with a bunch of flaming footballs drawn on it, and a cartoon version of Mike Domsky smoking a cigar and flanked by 2 busty bikini girls. Unfortunately, this drawing was no sick fantasy. Mike Domsky actually got girls to like him. Sure, he was a football player, and yeah, he hung out with the popular kids, but the guy was a total scumbag, preying on girls too stupid to know better. There seemed to be a sad learning curve on that sort of thing. Underneath his drawing, he'd actually written, Domsky for Prez. And he hadn't even bothered to rip the page out properly. The bottom left corner was missing, and he had proudly photocopied the jagged paper fringe. Mike Domsky, I said aloud.
You're kidding,
Autumn grabbed the flyer and made a face.
Ew, why is Mike Domsky running for student council?
I actually had to think about it. Maybe to help his college applications, or just to be an ass? That was really all the reason someone like Mike would need.
I'm going to take so much satisfaction in watching you annihilate him.
Autumn searched a nearby wall.
What are we going to do with all your posters? He's left no room to hang them up. This can't be legal. Do you want me to try to find Miss B?
Don't worry, I said. And then I taped my biggest poster right over a bunch of Mike Domsky's stupid cartoon grins. By lunch, Mike's posters had begun to disappear. I wondered if Miss B had gotten word that he'd charmed the school secretary for use of her copier and deemed them against election rules. But no, kids had been ripping them down on purpose. I watched a line of guys in the cafeteria ask Mike to autograph them because they'd be worth something someday, which basically made me want to puke. Over the rest of the week, I did my best to ignore Mike Domsky. It wasn't hard. He wasn't in any AP classes, and we certainly didn't have any friends in common. Still, even from afar, watching him ham up his whole candidacy drove me crazy. The way he'd strut around making ridiculous decrees in old English that started with henceforth and ended with evermore and demanded that people address him as prez. But I stayed calm and collected even when Mike took direct aim at me. It really didn't bother me all that much, probably because I was one of a rare few at Ross Academy to see guys like Mike for who they really were, power-drunk meatheads who'd do anything to get a laugh. High school was the best Mike Domsky's life would ever get. You could see his entire depressing future written on his dopey face. He'd get into some mediocre college, fall in love with a pregnant stripper, lose all his money to a get-rich-quick internet scheme. I might have even felt bad for Mike Domsky if he hadn't been acting like such a jerk. But Autumn hated watching Mike make fun of me, and no matter how stupid his insults were, it ate away at her. Like this one time in the cafeteria, when Mike stood underneath one of the banners we'd painted together, flashing two thumbs up and screaming something about me having wicked bubble letter skills. Autumn's cheeks blushed the most awful shade of purpley red, the same as the undercooked steak on her tray. She kept her eyes locked on that steak, pushing a grisly piece back and forth with a plastic fork that was about to snap in her death grip. And then, without warning, she shot straight up, bumping our table so hard my soda splashed on my lab worksheet.
"Leave her alone," she said, over-enunciating each word in as stern a voice as someone as sweet as Autumn could muster. I looked up at her with a half-smile, shocked that she'd had the guts to say anything. She was shaking, the tiniest quivers. My heart broke, knowing what a good friend I had in Autumn. If that was hard for anyone to do, it was hardest for her. Mike reacted like Autumn had suddenly appeared out of thin air, with phony surprise and awe. He strutted over to our table, sniffing the air like a bloodhound tracking a scent, and stopped right in front of her.
"Hey, fish sticks, I didn't smell you there."
Those words sucked the air out of the entire cafeteria. I couldn't move. I couldn't look at Autumn. I just listened through the silence for her next to me, praying that she remembered to breathe. I had always wondered when the rest of the school would figure out that joke wasn't funny anymore. Or maybe it was something closer to hope. Hope that with each passing year, people would forget. But in that moment, I finally understood that would never happen. Someone would say it at our 20th reunion, and Autumn would have to explain it to her husband. Fish sticks would get a cheap laugh somewhere for the rest of our lives. It was too easy, too mean, and I found it piercingly unfair that someone like Mike Domsky would never comprehend how much those two words destroyed my beautiful best friend. Anger rose up inside me like lava. I reached for the closest object and hurled it at Mike. That turned out to be my slice of pizza, and it hit him square in the chest, leaving a triangle stain of oil and sauce and hot pepper flakes behind on his shirt before it fell with a splat on his brown suede shoes. "Oops," I said in my most unsorry voice. A bunch of people gasped, and I even got a few laughs. Mike curled his lip.
"Damn. You know what? I threw out the student council handbook Miss B gave me, but I'm sure I saw a whole section about election rules and the kind of stunts that could disqualify a candidate. Tell you what, Natalie, I'll double-check if she has an extra copy and let you know."
I rolled my eyes as Mike stalked off. But really, inside, I panicked. Had I ruined everything just to defend Autumn's honor? Had I handed the entire election over, the thing I'd been dreaming about and working toward for the last 3 years, to Mike Domsky? Tears welled up in Autumn's eyes. "Come on," I said, stuffing our things into my book bag. I didn't want her to humiliate herself even more. "Let's go to the library."
"I'm so sorry, Natalie," she whispered. "I hope I didn't get you in trouble. I'll die if you get disqualified."
Autumn moved too slow, so I grabbed her hand and pulled her along. "You didn't have to defend me like that," I muttered. "If she could have just ignored Mike like I did, this wouldn't have happened." She shook her head.
"That's what best friends do for each other," she said with resolve.
Autumn wiped her eyes with one hand, and with the other she squeezed mine tight, the way I'd always squeezed hers. Chapter 3. I am not an every cloud has a silver lining type of person, but one undeniably good thing did come out of the original fish sticks debacle. It saved my friendship with Autumn. Autumn and I had met forever ago at the pool. We were six. Our moms had signed us both up for swimming lessons. Autumn had gone to Ross Academy since kindergarten, but I went to public school, so I'd never seen her before. I noticed her right away. Her blonde hair was light, like the underside of a lemon peel, and it hung all the way to her waist. I liked the way it floated through the water and watched with utter fascination as it turned green from the chlorine over the course of her lessons. But that's not why I really noticed her. It was because Autumn was the most spastic swimmer in the pool. She'd splash more than anyone else and always looked somewhat distressed. When the lifeguard made us partners, I groaned, because each lesson ended with a kickboard race and the winners got to pick a Jolly Rancher out of a big glass bowl in the pool office. I pretty much knew Autumn and I would never have a chance. We didn't, either. We never won a single Jolly Rancher. Even though I was probably the fastest kickboarder in the pool, I could never go fast enough to compensate for her. I would have been mad, but Autumn was so nice. Once I'd shared my towel when she'd forgotten hers, and she said thank you about a million times. And she was surprisingly silly, too. She taught me how to make a particular kind of fist that when you squeezed, it would shoot a stream of water. Except those things didn't exactly make us friends, just girls who swam together. My parents both had extremely demanding jobs, Mom at her architecture firm, and Dad at his ophthalmology practice. Either one would show up exactly 5 minutes to three, and I'd get put in the car, even before I'd had a chance to properly dry off. Autumn, on the other hand, would make plans to play with one girl or another as soon as she was out of the pool, like swim class was a warm-up for the fun she was about to have. It wasn't until the very last lesson, when the lifeguard let kids jump off the highest diving platform, that Autumn and I bonded for real. Autumn froze with terror, but I forced her up the ladder with me, mainly because none of the other girls in class would do it, probably because they all wore two pieces and a jump that big could easily make you lose your top. They hung near the shallow end and laughed as the boys leaped off and did ninja kicks or screamed like Tarzan. I wasn't scared, but it did feel like we were climbing forever. At the top, I laced our wrinkly fingers together and counted to three before jumping. Well, I jumped. Autumn sort of got pulled along with me, screaming the whole way down and getting water up her nose once we plunged in. She doggy paddled out of the pool, coughing hard. I followed her, feeling terrible, and decided that I would sit out with her for the rest of the lesson. Instead, Autumn raced to the ladder. She kept jumping on her own. Each time she'd spring a little higher, a bit farther out. I loved watching her test herself. Autumn had real courage, buried deep down inside her. All she'd needed was a push from me. We announced ourselves as best friends when our moms arrived to pick us up that day. Autumn and I were definitely an odd couple. She would show up at my house in a skirt and sandals, even though I'd tell her I wanted to try to get the boys down the block to invite us to play manhunt. She'd say I was the worst fingernail painter in history, and that she'd do a better job with her left hand than I'd do with my right. I wasn't a tomboy. Sure, I'd wear my cousin Noah's hand-me-downs, but sometimes I'd pick out a sundress, even if we weren't going to church or out to dinner. I had a collection of stuffed bears that lived in a nylon hammock strung over my bed, and I cried like a baby the time Christopher Clark threw a garden snake he'd found behind his garage at me. But before Autumn, I really never had any friends who were girls. None lived on my street. Autumn was like fizzy water, light and bubbly. I always knew it, but when I transferred to Ross Academy for junior high, it really became clear. For the first time, I saw how effortlessly Autumn made friends, much more easily than I did. So many people would say hi to her in the halls. I remember feeling lucky that I had gotten in early. Lucky, and a little nervous. She'd get invited to sleepovers. She'd have girls wanting to sit next to her at lunch. Even though Autumn stuck by me, I could still feel her drifting away. Not intentionally, of course. But I think saying no to invitations and trying to score me pity invites had started to get a little old for both of us. Autumn explained I could be a know-it-all sometimes, only she said it in a much more polite and gentle way. I didn't deny it. My parents were both intellectual types, and that sort of thing permeated everything we did as a family. We had our kitchen radio always tuned in to NPR. We did brain teasers over dinner. We shared the Sunday paper. And family vacations were to science centers or fossil expeditions or historical monuments. Maybe it made me weird, but it definitely made me smarter than most people I knew. But smart didn't necessarily cut it in junior high. I had invited Autumn to come with my family to a laser show at the planetarium. Her face fell, and she explained that she'd accepted an invitation from Marcy Cooperstein's family to visit their lake house for a week. I played it cool, but inside, I steamed. Marcy had been trying to edge in on my friendship with Autumn for months. Autumn had held Marcy off, but I guess the promise of jet skis and barbecues and bunk beds were too much for her to resist. It was 7 days of pure misery for me. I made my mom take me to the library about 4 different times because all I did was sit in my room and read. By that time, the other kids on the block weren't friends, only boys to feel awkward around. I had no one else. When Autumn did come back, tanner than I'd ever seen her, she slept over 4 nights straight and gave me a friendship bracelet she'd made especially for me, courtesy of Marcy's bead kit. She had used the nicest beads, too. Lavender glass spheres alternating with iridescent stones shaped like tiny grains of rice. Every time Marcy saw that bracelet, she seethed. I wore it until the string broke, and then I picked up all the beads I could find. I still have a few in my jewelry box. I guess that kind of competition should have prepared me for Chad, but it didn't. Guys were not a part of our equation. We didn't even talk about them. That probably sounds weird, but our friendship had this strange, timeless innocence about it, and though I knew I could compete with the Marcy Coopersteins of the world, I was no match for Chad. Chad swept Autumn completely off her feet. Once, I was at her house practicing a dialogue for our French project when Chad called and invited Autumn to meet him and some friends down near Liberty River. Autumn assumed I wouldn't want to go, but I told her I would. It made me happy how excited she was to have me go with her. Excited until she gently urged me to change into one of her sweaters and to try some of her berry lip gloss. I had a weird feeling when Autumn took my hand and we veered off the sidewalk into a thin patch of woods. We followed a worn stretch of dirt littered with trash and a few cigarette butts. I was pretty disoriented even though I could hear the river, but Autumn walked like she was both Lewis and Clark. After a few twists and turns, we came upon a big boulder perched over the silvery water. A bunch of guys sat on it, drinking beers and blowing smoke into the night sky. We were the only girls there. Looking back, I definitely overreacted. But older boys and beers and dark, dark woods were so far out of my realm of experience. After about 10 minutes, I pretended to feel sick. Autumn knew I was faking and let me walk home by myself. She only invited Marcy Cooperstein after that. I thought I'd lost her. Then the fish sticks incident happened, and I was the one person who stood by her. To everyone else at school, she was tainted. The boys were grossed out by her, and even some girls were snooty and snotty and suddenly too good for her. Marcy actually laughed a few times at the jokes other people made, right in front of Autumn. I told Marcy that she was pathetic, and then I happily picked up the slack. I walked in front of Autumn, or struck up a loud conversation about absolutely nothing, casting the best friend force field to distract her from the sniffers and the stinky faces. I think some people were afraid of me. I became known as the nerdy girl with a scary intensity who'd do anything to protect fish sticks. A couple of weeks later, Marcy apologized to Autumn in a note she'd written during chorus. Autumn showed it to me. It was full of grammatical errors. "You're right to be mad at me," Marcy wrote. "Idiot." I thought Autumn would write Marcy back, but she crumpled up the note and flushed it down the toilet. I'd never been more proud of her. With my help, Autumn turned her negative into a positive. Together, we channeled our energy into schoolwork. Autumn was never a great student, and that first semester of freshman year, she'd nearly failed out from the stress of everything that had happened. But I helped her come around. We'd take our lunch in the library and study or do homework together. I even got her involved with student council. Autumn still didn't do well enough to make it into AP classes, but she made regular honor roll, and so long as she didn't royally screw up her SATs, she'd have her pick of colleges. After Chad Rivington, Autumn never had another boyfriend. It saved her from a lot of needless heartbreak. And me? Well, the whole thing just let me be a good best friend, which was all I'd wanted to do in the first place. Chapter 4. On Monday, I found one of my posters taped to the wall above my locker. The Friday before, it had hung near the main office, and my original pieces of masking tape were still stuck to the corners. The poster had a picture of me on it, holding a jacket in each hand during last year's winter coat drive. It read, "Vote for Natalie, a leader with experience." Mike, obviously, had taken a marker and done some doodling at my expense. He had given me a mustache, drawn two enormous penises, one for each of my hands, and a bunch of question marks hovering over my head. He'd crossed out leader and written virgin on top of it, and squeezed the word no in before experience. The hallway was empty, but it wouldn't be for long. The classrooms were still locked from the weekend, so I couldn't grab a chair. After jumping up a few times in a desperate and unsuccessful attempt to reach the poster, I headed straight for Miss B's office, walking so fast that my knee socks slid down my calves. I had expected Mike Domsky to retaliate for Friday's pizza incident, of course. I knew he'd want to embarrass me like I'd embarrassed him, but his attack was worse than any grease stain. It was degrading. Miss B sat at her desk, blowing through the cloud blossoming from her ceramic cup cradled in her hands. Even though she was in her early 60s, Miss B was tan and fit and beautiful, in a loose black linen dress, a tangle of turquoise and red glass beads, and leather slides the color of honey. Her thick white hair curled off her forehead like the crest of an ocean wave and pooled at her shoulders. She had a stack of papers and folders before her. It took a few seconds and a small fake cough for her to notice me lingering outside. Miss B looked up and said,
"Natalie, good, I wanted to talk with you today. Come in and close the door behind you."
I was too angry to sit, so I stood just inside her office with the doorknob pressing into my back. "Mike Domsky defaced one of my posters." My voice quivered, and I sounded like a little baby. I hated that Mike could get under my skin so bad.
"Are you sure it was him?"
"Yes." I glanced at the clock above her head. If we didn't act fast, students would soon be arriving, looking at that poster, laughing at me.
"You saw him do it?"
"No." My face burned. "But I know it was Mike, and he wrote terrible things about me." I thought about telling her exactly what terrible things, only I was too mortified.
"I see."
Miss B set her cup down.
"Is it true you threw a slice of pizza at Mr. Domsky last Friday?"
My chin hit my chest.